a grateful, enthusiastic, and very, very active member of the Al-Anon family groups. My name is Jack Carpenter. Can you hear me in the back? Okay. If you can't hear me, start doing jumping jacks or something so I'll know and I'll get closer to the mic. I can't tell you how excited I am to be here. This is my second trip to Man-to-Man. How many people were first time this weekend? First time Man-to-Man? I think I can demonstrate to you the nature of the place where you find yourself. How many people have been here five times or more? Show of hands. Must be a reason they're all coming back, right? This is my second time here. I was here, I think it was 13 years ago, Tim, 13 years ago. And it was a significant milestone and turning point in my life. I had 10 years in Al-Anon when I walked through these doors. And it was one of the first places that I've ever encountered that consistently treated me like I wasn't a little kid, like I somehow wasn't the junior program in training for AA. that I was welcome and that I was equal and I'd earned my seat the same as everybody else in this place. And I owe that to the people that I met when I came here 13 years ago. I've been on the phone today as much as I could be on the phone with my cell service. I've talked to several people. My friend Josiah, who was here last year, sent his best regards to you. He's had one of his sponsees was found dead yesterday morning, a dear friend of mine, so we got a lot of stuff going on at home. I just got off the phone with Bo T, who, when I told him that you can come back to speak at this conference, but you have to wait 15 years, said to remind you that he's been 14 since he was here. I'm just saying. And I'm not standing before you because I'm an expert on recovery or on Al-Anon or because I'm a particularly good speaker or, more importantly, because I have any desire to be up here talking to you. It's a privilege that I get asked to do it, but it really is not something that I seek out to do. But I do this because I owe a lot of people who came before me, who stood at microphones like this in other parts of the country and began to sing to me the music of recovery from AA and Al-Anon, and I owe that debt to them that I'll never be able to pay back. And there's a man in this room, I don't spot him at the moment, but I'm sure that he's here, who after I'd followed my wife into AA to make sure that she was listening properly at her AA meetings 26 years ago, I went every week to give her the old elbow because there were some pertinent and salient points that she needed to pay attention to. I went to my first ever AA conference. It was a huge one in California, and I went to exactly one meeting that weekend. I went to the banquet Saturday night and heard my first ever banquet AA speaker, and he's here tonight. Are you here? Stick your hand up. Bob B. from Minnesota. And after hearing what he said from the podium, the next day I called the central office in Los Angeles and had him send me a directory. Determined to get to a meeting and get something I didn't know much about, but was very attractive to me because I heard the music of recovery that night as well. What happened to me 13 years ago when I came here is I collected a lot of people who I kept for years after that. I had to come all the way to Texas to meet Mac B. I knew his wife for years. I knew that he was somewhere. We always suspected she'd killed him and buried him in the backyard because we never saw him. And when I got here, here he was, and Charles, and Tim, and oh my God, so many people have become largely important to me in my recovery. And I'm back here. It was such a treat to come back and to talk to you guys. And I got the privilege last time I was here of spending some time with some people who have shared with me significant changes that my being willing to give them some time, which was always given freely to me, made in their life. And I'm always deeply honored and humbled. I was talking to Tim in the car today that, you know, when you go do something like this, you don't know. You don't know if you did anything good or bad. It doesn't really make any difference to me. If you like me or don't like me, it's not my business. I've been well trained in my recovery. But once in a while, you get to find out from somebody later on that you've made a significant difference in their life. And it's a privilege. It's not something that I need, but it's a privilege. A great, very great lady in Al-Anon, one time we were at a conference and she shared about the loss of a child. And as we were in the car pulling out to go to the airport, a woman raced up to the car crying. And she rolled the window down and spoke to her for just a moment or two. And the woman had just lost a child. And When we pulled out to go to the airport, she says, you know, most of the time I don't get to know why I'm here. Today I know that I'm here because of that woman, right? And what I'm talking about is humility, something which I seek, something which if I tell you I have it, I lose it immediately. But it's what I want to grow up to be like. I'm such a lucky man. I give you, first of all, I want to tell you that Tim picked me up at the airport. He couldn't wait when he heard I was going to come back again to come and get me. And today I realized I'd forgotten my tie. And I know when you come to this part of the country, if you don't come without a tie, they give you one with 13 coils in it, you know. So we made a hot run to the Walmart to get a tie in his Honda car. And I don't usually break my career anonymity, but I have to tell you that 38 years as a Hollywood stuntman does not prepare you for riding with Tim in his Honda car. Just saying, I'm not judging, I'm just saying. And we did a good job, didn't we? It's a good match. I bring you greetings from my home group in La Cañada, California. Josiah comes from that same group where two nights ago there was probably 120 or 125 guys at a men's stag Al-Anon meeting. My last two sponsors have come from people in that group. My sponsor is Willie W. from Southern California, and I spoke to him yesterday. And I bring you greetings from my beautiful wife, at whose courtesy I am here tonight. I'll tell you that my wife had surgery today for skin cancer. She's probably got between 40 and 60 stitches in her legs and her back. She's had more than 200 surgeries to remove melanoma and squamous cell cancer. And that when she got done, she called me from my daughter's school where she was taking care of business, getting her books turned in and getting her graduation announcements. And that tomorrow morning at exactly 9 a.m., she'll jab a needle in her abdomen and inject herself with chemotherapy. And believe me when I tell you that I would much rather be home with her. I really kind of like her now at 25 years of sobriety. But she owes like I owe, and she's picking up the slack while I'm here so I can come and be with my people and do what you guys have asked me to do, and I'm deeply honored to be here. I grew up in a home that was deeply affected by alcoholism. It wasn't in the conventional sense. I do not believe my parents were alcoholic. In every direction, in both sides of the family, alcoholism was rampant. When I got to AA with my wife and then I got to Al-Anon, a year and a half after she was sober, because I was a slow study, I was certain that she was the very first alcoholic which I had ever encountered. But in the light of the information that I got at open AA meetings and at Al-Anon meetings, I began to understand that alcoholism had been that thing that had been devastating my family for generations and continues to do so. To my knowledge, as I stand here right now, there's only two members of my family in recovery or in sobriety. Is my beautiful wife, Leslie, who sends you her very best, and my son, who's got about 2.5 years of sobriety in AA. I'm reasonably certain that when I was here last time, I was talking to you about my going to meetings and trying to work on a deal where I didn't have any power over his sobriety, even though I had an awful lot of information. I was at a meeting the other day with a woman whose son died of the disease earlier this year, and I was sitting next to her in a meeting, and she shared that I had spoken to her when he was out there, and she told me she had to tell him this information about where recovery was and what it looked like and what he needed to do. And what she said, and I don't really remember the conversation per se, but I believe her, she said that I told her that your son desperately needs to have the information that you've got. And you are the only person from whom he cannot hear it, right? And she buried that one. And she was grateful for that conversation because she got to have more or less of a relationship with him instead of being a pariah that he had to avoid because she was beating on him about going to AA or sobriety or his problem, because that's where we go. We drive them off. We don't fix them. The biggest lesson I ever got here was that those people who are close to me are the only ones I can't help. You know, I'm too close to him. I can't help my wife with her sobriety, no matter how many meetings I go to or how much I know. I cannot help my son in his sobriety. I can't help anybody who I'm close to with problems with alcohol and drugs because they're too close. But I know people, and some of them are in this room, who would do anything to help them if they're willing to make the phone call. And I'm a guy who's standing here whose phone number is in a lot of wallets, with parents mostly, and sometimes husbands, who are waiting for the question from their wife or their child, I need help, can you help me? At which point they pull out the phone number and say, I can't help you, but here's somebody who can, because that's what I did. I believe it's why my son is sober today and not dead of his disease, because he was headed that direction. That family was pretty wild and woolly. There was a lot of violence. I'm a guy who, I don't know if I suffer from post-traumatic stress, but if you put one finger on a doorknob in a room where I'm sleeping, I'm awake right now. Because I spent my whole life knowing that my reaction times, my life depended on that. There was an awful lot of violence. There was gunplay. There was car chases. There were gang fights, and that was just among the people I was related to. We occasionally would invite the neighborhood to come along. It wasn't like we kept it all to ourselves, and that's what it looked like. And that was how I came out of the house that I grew up in, thinking I was normal and thinking that I escaped. You know, I'm looking around at the madness in my house. My parents were terribly affected by alcoholism in their parents. And there was lying and violence and infidelity and gunplay. And I haven't talked about this in years, but there was a time where my dad and my stepmom had an argument. And stepmom, for a change, got to the pistol first. It was a .45 caliber, 1911, you know, target slide, nickel chrome, .45. Standing in the kitchen in the house we lived in, pointing it at his chest, and pulled the trigger. And she said, this thing's broke. My dad said, let me see that. He snapped the safety off, and he pointed at the wall and shot a round through the wall in the neighbor's house. He says, no, it seems to be working fine. Handed it back to her. I never saw that on Leave It to Beaver. They didn't do that on my three sons. And I just came out of that house just a little bent up, and I thought I was escaping. And what I did was I moved in. I was 16 years old when I got out. I was working three jobs, and I moved in with my 16-year-old girlfriend and her drunk mom, who was too disabled by her alcoholism to work, and I supported the whole house. We call that out of the frying pan into the fire. And I thought I got away. And I've since been educated that that wasn't the case. There's a lot of water under that bridge. I'm not sure that I want to talk about all of it. I will tell one story that I always tell, and then I want to move on to what's been going on the last couple of years. Because if you've been in recovery a while, you know that the road gets narrower. The things that were acceptable to me in first 5 or 10 years of recovery are very slippery areas for me now, and that gets to be a narrower set of solutions to my problems. I was the guy who, in my family, watching everybody drink, I couldn't wait to drink and be like them. I need to tell you, to my everlasting shame, that I am a failed alcoholic. I really tried to achieve, just a blackout would have been good. I would have given anything to have just one blackout, because I would see, you know, my brothers would get bigger and stronger and win the fight or lose the fight. They don't care. They get the girl. There was all these adventures and heroics. I couldn't wait to do that. And I found that alcohol did not do for me what it has always done for the people I'm close to. That I lack a specific gene chain in my makeup that doesn't allow me to react chemically to the chemical alcohol like every alcoholic in my life. My wife and I were talking about it a couple of years ago, and I said, you know, when I drank, the reason I didn't drink very well and I quit drinking by the time I was old enough to drink, I was already pretty much done, is that when I drank, I would lose control. And when you grow up in a violent, scary place like I did, control is a valuable commodity, and I could not afford to be out of control. And my wife looked at me for a moment. She says, what you never understood about the disease of alcoholism is that when I drank, it gave me control. Two sides of exactly the same coin. In order to find a role where I deserved and belonged and had the right to breathe your air, I've got to find a place to fit. I don't measure up in testosterone because I don't drink enough to be as brave as I saw them being. I don't measure up in the area of drinking and partying with my buddies and with my family. And the role that I adopted for myself is I'm the one that you go to fix it. They call me from the jail, and they call me from the bar fight, and they call me from the courthouse, and they call me to come and get it. Everybody in my family, I'm 911 on every phone in my family. There's a very good reason for that. They don't really call 911 because at any given time there are probably police looking for some members of the household. It would be ill-advised to have them come and adjudicate some other subject and notice that they are there. So they call me. And one of the calls that I got, which in looking back really, you know, cemented my seat in the Al-Anon program, I got a call at 3 o'clock in the morning, 2:30, 3 o'clock from my stepmom, the one that was going to shoot Dad, remember her? And she said, your brother's been in a fight at the bar. He tangled with about 8 guys and they broke the windows out of his van. They tried to drag his girlfriend out the window as he was driving out of the parking lot, dragging 6 or 8 of them. He came home and he got the shotgun and he's gone back to the bar. And you need to go get him. Now, I don't know about you, but there was no question in my mind that that was my job, because I'm the guy to go get him. And I got in my car, 3 o'clock in the morning. I drove down. The very first place I checked was a pizza place that I knew him and my brothers frequented and drank a lot of beer at. And there he was in the parking lot of a closed bar. They closed at 2 o'clock. There's nobody home. And he's sitting in the van, and there's broken glass all around it because he parked in the same spot. And he's got the shotgun propped up against the windowsill. I get out of my car. My sponsor has assured me that I have the incredible ability to ask annoyingly obvious questions of the alcoholic. And as I approached the car, I said, so, what are you doing? To which he replied, and I'm sure it made perfect sense to him in his inebriated state, he said, I'm waiting for them to come back. And, you know, the bars don't open back up in California until 6 a.m. It might be a while if he's still conscious when they do come back. And I figured it's an easy night in the hero business. And I said, I'll be having the gun. And he gave me that shotgun. And I cracked the breech and I popped those 2 shells out of it. And I dropped them in the trunk. And I dropped the gun in the trunk. And I went, I'm okay to live on the planet one more day among you. And I'm heading for my car. And he says, well, I'm going to find them. We have values in my family. One of them, principle among them, is that anytime you get your ass handed to you in a fight with overwhelming odds, the very first thing which occurs to you is to go find them and have them kick your ass some more. He's pretty drunk. I'm pretty sure he can't find the driveway, so it should be a low-impact night. And I said, you go with God, and I got in my car to leave. Now, we had CB radios in all of our cars. I come from generations of truck drivers, and I was heading out the driveway when my radio came on. It wasn't 60 seconds after I left him, and he said, I found them. They're around the back. And I turned my little car around, and he had gone left, so I went right, and I went around his big shopping center and the pizza place right in the middle of this side. And as I come around the corner, I can still see in my mind's eye there's about 5 acres of empty asphalt. There's one light pole that I remember for sure. There's 3 cars parked pretty tight around it, and there's about 7 or 8 guys having a beer standing in the parking lot. Way over there, about a quarter mile away, is headlights. That's Brother's headlights. And he's got that driveway exit covered, and I got this driveway exit covered, so all 8 of them are surrounded. If you want to talk about step 2 later, I'm available. And my radio comes on, and it says, I'm going in. I know we had some newcomers in Al-Anon, so I will translate that for you. That means we're going in. I see Brother's headlights jump to a pretty bright state. I know he's on the gas and he's coming, and so I'm coming like I've got any choice. I'm going in. And I'm trying to figure out how not to die tonight, because if we're going in against 8 guys, Brother's too drunk to get out of the car, so I figure I'm going to have to take care of at least 7 in order not to get killed, and I had to come up with a plan. My plan was to get going in there pretty hard. You've heard what I do for a living, to grab the emergency brake on my car, get it sliding sideways, and slide sideways into the first car facing towards me in the hopes of pinning 2 or 3 of those guys between the chassis and give me a chance to get out of the car, because I believe my life depended on it. And I'm going to tell you, I'm one of the most dangerous things on the planet. It's not because I'm a tough guy or because I'm good in a fight. I'm a guy who's really afraid. I'm afraid I'm going to get killed going in there against the odds that we're going in on, and I think it's a pretty good possibility. I'm trying to narrow the numbers down. But there's one thing that I fear more than that, only one, and that is if I don't, what will they think of me at home? What's Mom and Dad going to think if I left him in there by himself? What's my family going to think if I left him and turned and went out of the parking lot? I'm more terrified for you to know that I'm afraid than I'm afraid to die. And I came across that parking lot, and I grabbed an emergency brake on my 69 Mustang and started the back end of the round, topped out in second gear at about 70 miles an hour, committed to running in there hard. And my radio came on one more time and said, I don't think that's them. Oh, by the way, I was stone cold sober this whole time, just so you know. And what I did was I gathered that car up, did some driving better than I maybe have ever done in my life, and I went by one more coat of paint out of hooked a car going by. I know it was really close and really fast. And I did not lift from the throttle until I was past little brother and out into the street, because I really didn't want to discuss my bad behavior with the gentleman in the cars. And I really didn't care about talking to baby brother at that point either. And I went home. And I told that story at my Monday meeting about, I don't know, 6 years ago, because they'd asked me to speak, and I told that story, and a gentleman walked up to me after the meeting, and he said, "That night in the parking lot when you almost ran those guys down," I said, "Yes." He said, "I was there." If I had any idea when I did my eighth step that some of those guys might show up, I might have reconsidered. Because it's only me and brother and eight guys I tried to kill. And he said, "No, I wasn't one of the guys. I was a little kid." And he said, "Your mom called my uncle before she called you. And we got there just ahead of you, and we were sitting in the corner of the parking lot, and I saw the whole thing sitting in the front of my uncle's car." And he says, "To this day, I cannot believe that you did not kill somebody that night." And he's the bravest man I have ever encountered in any meeting in my life, because the very next thing out of his mouth was, "Will you sponsor me?" I tell that story for another reason, and it relates to some of the conversations that I had with people here when I was here last time. And that is that when I got that call at 2:30 in the morning, I wasn't a teenager making a bad choice. I'd just gotten out of the United States Marine Corps in 1976, right at the end of Vietnam. I was a sergeant in the Marine. I had a wife and two children in that house. As a matter of fact, next to my side of the bed, there was a crib with my little girl, who was a year old, in a full coma from a drowning, hooked up to a lot of expensive medical equipment to monitor her breathing and her heart. She had a trach tube in her neck and a feeding tube in her stomach, and she was in a profound coma. And I walked by her crib and by the door of my son, the one who has 2.5 years of sobriety now, to get in my car and take an action, because I believed I had no other choices than the choices I was making that night that I guarantee you would have taken me out of that house and away from that family as a sole form of support. And the other thing is, and this is that thing I drug into my inventory with my sponsor, believing that there was some things that you could not repair that were so broken in me and that were so bad that you could not fix, and I was wrong, was that for the year that that child lay in a coma next to my side of the bed requiring 24-hour-a-day constant care, I did none of it because I could not. I'm the guy who, when you're in the bar and I start knocking the tops off the bottles, you want a sick, crazy bastard like me watching your back. But I can't show up and be a husband or a father at a time when my family needed me to be both of those things more than anything, and I couldn't do it because I would stand at the foot of my daughter's crib and I would look at her and listen to the heart monitor and listen to the phlegm coming in and out of her trach tube constantly and the suction machines. And when the feelings got right to the point where they might get away, and I believed beyond a shadow of a doubt that if they did, my life was over, I fled my house. That's the shame I took into my inventory with my sponsor, knowing full well that there was no tools for that. And I was wrong. And when I talked about that 13 years ago, I sat down with some people and talked about making amends to somebody who's no longer alive from my experience, not from my wisdom. I made that amends graveside 12 years after she died, because I had not been to the cemetery in 12 years because I couldn't go. I went. That was then. This is now, moving on. I've got no tools to deal with the emotions. I got nothing. I don't go. I'm going to tell you, and there's a lot of people in this room I know who know it better than I do, that on that day that I threw that switch off on those painful, scary emotions, I shut them all off. It isn't like you get to pick and choose. It's not a buffet. I would remember things like, a year after she died, I would wonder what I was supposed to feel like having lost a child, because I had no idea. I would wonder what it felt like to lose somebody who I cared about or to have a tragedy in the family. I would wonder what it was like to really love somebody because all that was gone. I didn't have another way to go. And I'm famous in my meetings at home many years later for a guy who came to me and he said, you know, I've been coming to meetings now for about 6 months, and I'd like to find out how to get in touch with my feelings. And apparently I said to him, because it's been quoted many times, I said, never mind that crap, do the steps, your feelings will be in touch with you. And that became my experience. There was a lot of water under that bridge. I never went back to that marriage. I was a guy who was unfaithful in that marriage, and I stayed gone 6 to 9 months of the year. In my industry, it's easy. I was just gone all the time, and I was afraid of her. She was way tougher than I was. She took care of that kid 24 hours a day for a year, and I couldn't do an hour's worth. And I still respect her to this day for that, but we're no longer married. And I met the woman who I've already introduced you to, my beautiful wife, Leslie, on location in a movie, and she came to California, and we were supposed to have a date, and she got in a terrible car wreck. And I was on my way to meet her, and I found the wreck, and she's in a car not breathing, and they're trying to get her out, and she's got Nebraska plates. They don't know who she is. And I followed the ambulance to the hospital, red lights and sirens. It wasn't to be the last time we were going to do that. And she died in the car, and in the hospital, she stopped breathing, and I ran out and called a nurse. And they called a code, and the lights over the door start blinking, and the bells are ringing, and they're doing cold blue room 4, and they come in with the crash cart, and they get her heart started again. And my wife Leslie was at the very end of her drinking, where dying looked preferable to living and paying the price again. And when she talks about on that time she was walking into the white light, and that they told her to go back, and she argued with them. Because, you know, they're waiting for her. They're going to arrest her. She's done it again. She'd crossed the center stripe and gone head-on with some poor woman driving her Oldsmobile down the highway and had buried her Honda Prelude in the nose of this car and had killed her twice that night, and they'd brought her back. And when they threw her out of the hospital because she had no insurance and it was a private little small hospital, they said, you got to go. They loaded her in my car with a neck brace, with having treated none of her wounds, having died twice tonight, and said, I hope you live near a hospital because she's not doing well. Now, I have a dilemma. When my sponsor has assured me that when confronted with a problem, the reason I must go to Al-Anon is because my solution makes my problem look good. I have my now seriously invalided date in the car, and I don't know where she lives, and she's drunk and hurt, and she doesn't know either. What do you do now? And she whispered to me, her windpipe was crushed on the windshield. She had broken bones and stuff. It was pretty bad. And she said, I guess you can take me to a hospital. And it took less than 8 seconds. I put my hand on top of hers on the seat. I remember it vividly. And I said, it's okay, honey. I got a better idea. I will take you home. If you all want to think about that for a minute, you may have forgotten I have a wife and a family at home. My solutions make my problems look good. And I went to a phone booth, that's how long ago this was, and I called home and I told my wife a lie, and I said, a friend's been a wreck, I'm bringing her home, and she met us in the driveway. And she grabbed Leslie's ankles, and I got her armpits, and we carried her in the house. My wife will tell you, if you have the privilege of hearing her from a podium, that as we came through the door, I dropped her. I don't remember that. Doesn't mean it's not true, but I might have been a little nervous bringing the girlfriend home to meet the wife and the kids for the first time. We put her in a bed in what is a room in the house where I still live, which is my office now. We took shifts around the clock watching her because she really wasn't doing very well and began to take care of her. And it set up 6 months of some very interesting living where my wife and my girlfriend are becoming friends. And my wife is confiding in my girlfriend that there may be some problems in our marriage. And my girlfriend, who now likes my wife because she's helping take care of her, starts giving her little helpful hints on how to spice up the relationship. But it's not unmanageable yet. When it became unmanageable was after about 4 months when Leslie was up and around and my wife began setting her up on double blind dates with our single male friends. Going out to dinner with your wife and your girlfriend and some poor schmo that thought he might get lucky later tonight is more complicated than all of the stuff before it. And it finally became unmanageable. And Leslie got a job offer in Houston, Texas. She went off to Houston to train in a restaurant chain that's based down there. And She was well enough to travel, and we packed her up and sent her off, and I set about dissolving a marriage that I had not been in for a long time. My wife, Leslie, will tell you that her MO was 6 months in a place. She would do good for a while and bad for a while, and she'd lose the job and move on, because she'd gotten to California from Nebraska doing that. And 6 months there, she got in trouble and lost her job and called and asked she'd come to California, and I went and got her. I went and packed her up lock, stock, and cat and brought her back to California to live happily ever after. I talked to a lady friend of mine whose husband's new sober in Florida, a business associate of mine who really burned it down good before he got sober about 90 days ago now. And they were really having a tough time in sobriety. She was having a tough time with him sober because he really wasn't very fun to be around anymore. And I need to tell you that I was with my wife for the last year and a half of her active drinking, towards the end of which she informed me that she thought the problem was alcohol, at which point I volunteered to help her to quit drinking, which is the scariest thing I may have ever said to her. And I was seriously unsuccessful, and she nearly died of her alcoholism right in front of my eyes. It was the most baffling thing I'd ever seen. And I was coming home from location to throw her out because she'd embarrass me again with the family. And everybody's gone by now. By this time, friends don't want to be around her drunk or around me when I'm with her. There's nobody. It's her and me and the cat, pretty much. That's where your world goes in the disease. And I was coming home to throw her out, and she tried to kill herself by drinking enough to die from it and kept waking up. And in desperation, she got in the Yellow Pages, and she called a place to get some treatment and checked herself in about a week before I got home to get sober. And I came home to a newly sober wife, and I had no idea. And here's what she said. Apparently, I told her, and again, I don't remember it, but I believe it's probably true, that towards the end of her active drinking, she told me that she didn't think she could get sober by herself and she needed some help. And in my arrogance and in my ego, which is the nature of my disease, what I said to her, if you go to anybody else for help, you're gone. And on the day when she made the decision to make that call, she did it with knowing that her living arrangement was in peril and that she'd be on the street if I knew. And when I came home after a week, she ran out of the house crying because I had a half a glass of wine. A half a glass of wine, by the way, my AA friends tell me is what alcohol abuse really looks like. And she ran out crying. I didn't even pay any attention. There's such madness by this point. And she walked in. She stood right in front of me on my couch in the living room. And she said, I know you told me that I would have to leave, but I couldn't do this alone. I had to get some help. And she told me that knowing full well that if she didn't get sober, she was going to die of her disease. And that if she told me the truth, she was going to have to go. And she told me anyway. That was a week into her sobriety, and she's not had a drink since then. This summer, she'll be 25 years sober in July. And I'm very privileged to have been a front row seat to that. Now, what I need to tell you is that when I talked to this lady in Florida and she was complaining about her newly sober husband, I said, I need to tell you that I would rather live through the last year of my wife's drinking, which was really bad, 10 times in a row than do the first year of sobriety again. Oh, my God, we hated each other. Holy crap. We went to the conference where Bob was speaking, and we're walking through the halls, and she's dragging me by the hand, and people looking at us going, mm-mm-mm-mm-mm. Who's got 4 days in the pool for how long they're going to stay married? It was not good. Because every time we had 5 minutes together, it was off to the races, man. She's calling her dad looking to move home, and I'm looking for a place to put her. We can't even be in the same room. She's calling her sponsor every day saying, Mrs. Leslie didn't drink today, think it'll be all right if I just get rid of that son of a bitch, call you tomorrow. And her sponsor, who's old hardline AA, says, honey, we don't make any major decisions for a year of sobriety, but somebody sick as you, it's three. And I'm going to tell you right now that if it wasn't for sponsorship, I wouldn't be standing here today as the happiest married man that I know, that my best friend on the planet is my beautiful wife, Leslie. That when I wake her up in the morning and she's seriously ill, I'm always up early with the kids, and when I wake her up, when she opens her eyes, she looks at me like she'd like to unzip my skin and crawl in. That she hates for me to go to work in the morning. She hates for me to leave the house. That we enjoy each other's company and we have a blast together. And I'd have missed all of that if it wasn't for sponsorship, hers and mine. She's going to AA. I don't know what that is. She's going to coffee afterwards and she's not coming home till 2 a.m. and I'm okay with that. You guys keep her till she's fixed. Or keep her completely. I never even asked any questions. And I was good with that because we just weren't doing well together. And then she asked me to go to some AA meetings with her because she says, the people in AA think you're my imaginary friend. Oh, my God, they think she's hallucinating. I better go get on top of this. So I went right with her to AA. And I went to a meeting in Simi Valley, California for 6 months where she was the permanent cookie lady. And I was the only non-alcoholic in the room. And I heard the music of recovery from sober alcoholics from podiums just like this that planted really important seeds and a lot of very important information with me. And they treated me like I belonged there. They were hugely kind to me. And they knew I was not alcoholic. But I really needed the information that they were putting down to learn about a disease that I don't have from the people who have it. And when a year and a half came and I went and I heard Bob talk at that conference and I called and snuck out to my first meeting, it was a year and a half into her sobriety. Because up until then, it's, I don't need to go to Al-Anon. It's, I don't have the problem. She has the problem. Leave me alone. I'm fine. But remember the guy I've described to you who doesn't feel anything and, you know, I've got this wall built up, which I thought was to keep you out and just kept me in, that wall. So I snuck out to a meeting because I needed what they had, and it was exactly what I was afraid it would be. It was eight little blue-haired women sitting in a circle. They had a meeting up the hall. It was an AA meeting called the Gong Show. You can imagine how the noise coming out of that room. That was a very active meeting. Some people are nodding their heads. They might know about it. And I'm in the room with the little blue-haired ladies, and I got nothing left. I got no better solution than to show up there and to be with the little blue-haired ladies. And I walked in and I took my chair. And those women changed my life. They told me that the thought processes I thought were uniquely mine, that turning off of the emotions, the sneaking around, the belief, and I think this crosses the lines of both programs, this nearly molecular-level belief that I still suffer from today, that if I can just get enough information, I will get the power back. If I know where she hides the bottle, if I know what she's thinking when she does some action, if I know where she is and what she's doing. Thank God they didn't have the ability to track her cell phone then. You'd have a different speaker. I'd still be hunting her on the internet, right? The information is fine, but it does not give me back the power that I gave up in the first step. And those women talked to me about that stuff, and they made me welcome there. And I went to a meeting that Saturday that was to become my home group, and I picked it. Now, I need to tell you, I seemed to be the only man anywhere in Al-Anon where I went. There was nothing creating testosterone for 100 miles of where my chair was. And I went anyway, and I'm trying to hide. I don't want to be new. I don't want them to know I'm new. I want them to think I'm visiting from New York office to see if they're doing it right. I'm not a new guy. I'm fine. So I get to the meetings early, I set up the chairs, I'm busy, 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 you can't talk to me because I'm doing the chairs, and I'm setting the literature, I'm making the coffee, and the meeting's on, when it's over, I'm cleaning it all up, and then I'm out of there. And I picked this meeting because I could ride my bicycle to it because I'm a long-distance cyclist. Figure I'd get a ride in there Saturday morning, about 18 miles up there, take in a meeting, and then I'd go ride about 40 miles going home, and cool, win-win, don't have to give up my ride. But my problem is I don't want to stand out. So I'm going to go to a room with 70 women dressed in my spandex, heat shrink to fit, no secrets from the world, road cone colored roadie bicycle suit to be the anonymous guy in the meeting. That was my plan. You know about my plan. So I got a backpack. I got street clothes and a backpack. I ride all the way up there. I get there way before anybody else is there. There's a patio off the side of the meeting. I go down the patio and I change into my street clothes. When you get there, I'm already in my street clothes. I'm through the door. We set up the meeting. I'm busy, busy, busy. I clean up the meeting. I'm the last one to go. They're all gone. I change back into my roadie suit, and I go. It was years before I figured out that there was a window in the back of that room that was a one-way glass with these thermal panes on it. And I need to tell you that if there's anybody early for the meeting, they got the whole show. And they let me alone because they knew I wanted to be left alone. And after 2 months, I had what I really believe was my first spiritual awakening. I realized that that was my chair, that they weren't going to ask me to leave it, that they couldn't take it away from me, that I'd earned that chair in that meeting by my behavior and my choices. It had nothing to do with her. They weren't going to ask me to leave because she was sober, because I was a guy, because I was somehow sick and twisted more than anybody else in the room. It was my chair to take, and I could take it if I want. I'll tell people that leave the meeting or come back after a long time, that chair has always had your name on it. We've never given it away, and it's yours to take. and we'll hold it for you forever if you want it. And that was my chair. I left my backpack home, and I showed up as a guy who rides bicycles. And I walked into that meeting in my spandex shorts. And my friend Patty walked up to me, and she patted me on my spandex butt, and she said, "You keep coming back." Now, I still don't like her too much. And the women in Al-Anon are treating me special. And I kept coming back. And we don't care why you keep coming back. Just keep coming back. You get it eventually. And I got a friend who lives outside of Dallas. She was in those early meetings. She had a couple of years when I came in, and she got real sick and had to move back home with her family and hadn't seen her in 20 years. And I called her when I spoke at the Al-Anon State Convention a couple of years ago, and just to tell her I was in the neighborhood to see if she was coming to the conference. And she said, "Well, no, I got the grandkids, and I'm here, you know, I'm a long ways out, and I'm not going to come." We chat on the phone. We started talking about the old days, and she goes, "Oh, I remember. You were like a rooster in the hen house. You could have had any of us." And I said, "And you waited 20 years to share this with me?" I thought they were all too well to sleep with me, or you probably would have a different speaker tonight. And I got in there, and I got a sponsor, and I got busy. And I got a woman sponsor because that's what there was. I didn't have a choice. It turned out that, you know, that shame and that guilt and that sick, twisted man that I am in the room, my sponsor was way sicker than me, and I thank God she shared that with me when I did my inventory with her. She told me that if I was in that chair every week, that guys were going to come and stay, and I was going to wind up sponsoring them. I needed to get busy on the steps, and I did. And I'm going to tell you, not to disrespect Al-Anon or its fine literature, but she took me through the steps in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in particular the inventory. And if it's not your thing, it's not your thing. I'm not telling anybody what to do, but that's what I did, and it's what I do with the men I sponsor. And I sponsor a lot of people all over the country and in several foreign countries because I'm a rare commodity. I'm a guy that works in an Al-Anon program, and I sponsor people, and I am somewhat famous at home for answering the phone no matter where I am. One of the guys shared at a meeting, and it's not entirely untrue, that I will answer the phone on the hood of a car on fire. I will tell them that I can't talk right now, I'll get back to you, but I almost always answer the phone. And I've sponsored a lot of people over the years. And I've been thinking about this, and I need to tell you about it because I never know what's going to happen when I come up here. About 4 years ago, 5 years ago, I'm sitting at the table. We have dinner together as a family, my wife and myself and my two adopted daughters. I get to them in a minute every night. And we sponsor a lot of people, so the phones are busy in our house. And we try and keep if it's dinner time and they don't have the gun in their mouth yet, we'll ask them to wait till after dinner and call them back. And that's only partially a joke, folks, and you know that. But she got a call just as we were sitting down from one of her sponsees who had gotten her first sponsee in AA. And she was so excited to be working with somebody. And she was going to her, they were reading the steps, she's taking her to me, she's talking to her on the phone, and the woman got drunk. And this lady was devastated, and she called my wife crying on the phone, so that's an exemption, she can talk during dinner, and we're sitting down at dinner, and wife's talking to her, and I overhear the conversation, and she says, "Yes, honey, that's right. They often drink. As a matter of fact, most of them are going to drink again." And she hung up the phone. And, you know, I've heard the numbers bandied around AA. I've been to more than 1,500 AA meetings as a guest of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the numbers I hear are things like 90% of the people who walk through that door are going to die drunk. I heard that some of the first meetings I was going to in Simi Valley, California. And I don't know if the numbers are accurate, but I know there's a lot of people that show up and we don't see again later. And then something occurred to me which I've never thought about before. I sponsor a lot of people, and I sponsor people who are in both programs. And there's a certain amount of controversy attached to that depending on the part of the country that you're in. And my only rule for sponsorship is that if you're an AA member when you come to me to work in an Al-Anon program, I require that you have an AA home group and an AA sponsor. Not for you, because I will get sick trying to help you with your disease. I need to make sure you've got a foundation in AA, and then I'll go anywhere you need to go. And over the years, I sponsored, when I was sitting at that table that night, there was probably 20 of the people that I sponsored who were also in the AA program. And it occurred to me that in all the years I'd been sponsoring and all the years I'd been sponsoring double winners, I'd never had any of them get drunk. I thought, well, that can't be, statistically cannot be that. I searched my memory banks. They'd come and gone, and we're talking about people working two programs now. I'm not their AA sponsor. I'm not helping them stay sober. Al-Anon's not helping them stay sober. None of them are getting drunk. So I started a little research project. And I called people around the country who sponsor in numbers like I do. I called Bo T. I called Kathy H. up in Ohio. I called Carol T. up in Northern California. I began making phone calls and asking folks, if you got people working two programs and you're sponsoring them, have you ever had any of them get drunk? And so far, and I've been looking from that day to this, it's been 4 years, the answer is zero, not a single one. Now, I'm not telling you that Al-Anon kept anybody sober, but the theory that I have is this. The level of humility it takes for somebody who's got sobriety in AA to come to me or come to a meeting or come to an Al-Anon sponsor and say, I got some time over here, but I don't know how to handle this part of my life. The level of humility to say that, I don't know how to do it, can you help me, apparently ensures these guys, inoculates them to a point where the odds of them picking up another drink is so far I have not found any. I don't know how that's possible. I'll keep looking, keep in touch. I'll let you know if they all break out drunk, but I'm still looking and I ain't found them. So if you're here and you're a member of Al-Anon and you're also a member of AA, good on you, man. You are welcome here. You have every right to the seat in Al-Anon that I do, based on your decisions and your actions in your life. It has nothing to do with whether you're an alcoholic or not. And if nobody else did, I welcome you to Al-Anon, and I'm so glad that you're here. I will also tell you that of those guys that I sponsored in both programs, and I've sponsored a lot of people and done a lot of inventory work, the biggest changes I've ever seen in anybody working in an Al-Anon program are the ones that came from AA. Guys who were successfully sober for a long time, who were tearing up their family and alienating their kids. And, you know, and I had one guy, I was telling somebody this weekend, I had a guy call me up and he said, I need a sponsor if I'm going to do this deal. He said, I need to tell you I got 25 years of sobriety. I work a good program. I got a sponsor. I use him. I go to meetings almost every day. I sponsor a bunch of guys. I'll be a low-maintenance sponsee. I said, oh, man, I've never had one of those. Bring it on. And we still laugh about this, and he shares about it at meetings. And it was 2 weeks later he called me walking the street crying and blowing snot bubbles, and he had made such an ass of himself in his family with his sober wife and alienating his kid that he was walking the street looking for a place where he can rent a room. And we laugh about him being a low-maintenance sponsee. This is a guy who came to me 25 years sober, spring-loaded in the pissed-off position just waiting for somebody to unload on. And he is one of the most changed men I've ever seen in my life. When we see them at a meeting, his wife runs across the room and throws her arms around my neck because Al-Anon restored her husband to her. It wasn't me. I get off of my soapbox and I get back to my own story. And it's just, you know, like I said, what's going to come out of here is none of my business. And I don't know whether it fits or who for it, but it's apparently what I'm supposed to talk about. I got busy in Al-Anon and I started getting service commitments. I started going places. That sponsor thought I needed to stay busy. I still have commitments. I'm not one who believes that you need to give the jobs to all the new guys, because when you give the jobs to all the new guys, the people who have been around for a while don't got a reason to come, and sometimes they wander off. I'm all for the new people getting a commitment, but I'm getting mine first, because I need to have a commitment at the meeting. And as I stand here today, I got commitments at conferences and at meetings back home, and I stay committed. And sponsorship is a big part of my life, and I'm very involved in that. And I started going places in service. I wound up on our service board in Southern California. I wound up as the chairman, a guy who had never even looked at the traditions and the concepts. And I had to go to a meeting to study the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts in self-defense, because they had all these little old blue-haired ladies with one eye in the middle of their forehead and a service manual under each arm. They were killing me. I had to defend myself. And I began to learn about the 12 steps and the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts and treat them all with equal say and equal sway. And I've got to tell you that I'm a married man today, largely because of the traditions and in part because of the 12 concepts of service. And later, if you want to talk about that, I'll tell you what that looks like. Figure out, you think about this, I'll give you a quiz for later. Figure out how you have a group conscience with two people. How you have a group conscience successfully where you have the moral high ground, which is what I always enjoyed when she drank. That we disagree and then I override her because I'm the biggest, I'm the loudest, I make the money, and I lived here first. And if she's wrong, I have to do what's right for the relationship. How do you have a group conscience? How does God speak to you through the conscience of the group? Talk to me later and I'll tell you how. It's in the 12 concepts of service under number 9. I sponsored a lot of people. My wife sponsored a lot of people. We got very close to them. I'm the AA chauffeur when she goes to meeting her and all of her girls. when she tells her story about living with me and my first wife together, people in the AA meeting assume that at least one of the girls is my other wife, a very understanding woman who is still with us. So I just call them my squadron of wives. Everywhere we go, I've got multiple wives. I have all of the downside and none of the perks of multiple marriages, I tell you right now. I know now that it really wouldn't work even if they were all giving up the booty, because it's a lot of work having that many women. My son ran off when he was 16. We were in recovery by that time. We'd made the best amends that we could do to him, and he went on a run that involved seven states with wants and warrants and a couple of bail bondsmen that wanted to see him. And we didn't know what the problem was. I really thought he was more like me than like the alcoholic, and it turned out I was wrong. He wound up in Oregon because their database wasn't talking with the other databases, and he roosted up there for a while. And you know what his problem was. It turned out he was drinking and drugging pretty hard. My wife sponsored a woman who couldn't stay sober. 5 years in and out, couldn't stay sober. Everybody loved her. She was like our kid. We would have given anything to have her not die of her alcoholism. And she wound up on the street with four kids. And my wife sent me to take her to a halfway house. I took an AA woman with me. I don't do AA 12-step work. I don't come equipped. And we took her and dumped her in a halfway house, really hoping that this might be the one. And it seemed like it for a while. And we wound up taking in two of the little girls, who were 3 and 5, while mom detoxed so that she wouldn't lose her kids to the system, off into foster care, because that's what would happen. And she got out. And she suffered from problems other than alcohol. And she was soon drunk again. And she didn't draw a sober breath again after that. And they never came back for the kids, her or her common-law husband. We wound up with children. It wasn't our plan. We didn't have a grinding need to have children. My son was grown and gone. My daughter was in the ground. I regretted for a long time coming into Al-Anon that I hadn't been able to show up for my daughter before she was in a coma, or after she died. And I didn't want to do the kid thing again, because it was not pleasant for me. And these kids had no place else to go. And when mom broke out drunk and went on a run again, we went to court and filed for a guardianship. And a year after we had them under a guardianship, I went to my wife and I said, I don't know about you, but I've decided that as far as I'm concerned, these kids are done traveling. They're either going home to a sober mom or they're staying here. And if you're okay with that, we need to do something about it. My wife agreed, and we pursued a very expensive, very painful process to adopt these little girls, who came with a lot of baggage. The little one was diagnosed bipolar 1, severe bipolar disease at age 4. She was taking a drug regime that I guarantee you, whether you are alcoholic or not, that if you took her morning dose of medication, you would go to bed and not get up for 3 days. A UCLA researcher walked me through that. He became her treating physician because he'd never seen a child present like her and be able to function on the meds that she was high functioning on. They came with baggage related to having grown up in a home that was terribly affected by their mother's alcoholism, where she was unconscious most of the time. Where when they heard stirrings in the house, they would run through the house screaming, we're hungry, we're hungry, we're hungry, because there was this much time before mom would go unconscious and there was nothing to eat. And they did that for a while. When they came to us, they'd hear me in the kitchen, here they'd come down the hall. I need to tell you, after about a year, you had to beat them to eat anything. But this is who came into my house. I don't know if I shared with you, I think it was after I came here the last time, when my daughter was 9 years old, the younger of the two. She became so violent because of her bipolar disease that she was ejected from every school in California that would take her. And she had to go away to Texas. She went to Devereaux down by Houston, Texas for 2 years. They sent a PET team, a psychiatric evaluation team, to her school when she melted down. And it took 12 grown men to capture and restrain my 65-pound, 9-year-old daughter and strap her to a gurney and take her to a psych ward. And I thought I would die. I was sure that what you guys made of me when I came to you, which was a good husband, I am a good husband today. I don't cheat on my wife. I don't have secrets from my wife. I'm a good and present husband. And it turns out that when these little girls came into my life, that amends that I made graveside to that little girl wasn't done. that there was a peace broken in here in a place where you couldn't reach, my sponsor couldn't reach, and God couldn't reach. And he put these two little girls in my house that looked exactly like my daughter, who was buried up on the hill, to reach in here to put that last couple of spots in place. And now they're telling me my daughter's got to go to a place where they can give her what I can't give her, and I'm dying. And I'm doing exactly what you told me, exactly what I talked to somebody at dinner about tonight. I'm going to meetings and I'm telling you the truth that I'm not good. I want you to think it's good all the time. I want you to know that this works. I don't want to tell you when it's bad. My ego doesn't want me to tell you when it's bad, and I'm telling you anyway. And at the break, I'm finding the newest guy and giving him my card. And my sponsor couldn't pull me out of that hole, that black place. And you guys couldn't pull me out, and going to meetings and service couldn't pull me out. A couple of those guys, turns out they had some sobriety, these guys that I got. Had no idea. They were calling me up and talking to me, and they were the ones that pulled me out of that hole. Working with another person in my program saved my ass. They didn't know for years after that, because I don't know about you, but when you get a new one, and I don't care if they've got time in AA when they come to Al-Anon, when they're new, they never ask how you are first when they pick up the phone. It's about she's doing this and they're doing that, and they didn't ask, so they didn't get the information. It takes a while to get around to that. And they pulled my ass out of the fire. I was told by psychiatrists and therapists, including this researcher from UCLA, that I needed to get used to the idea that that little girl was going to live most of her life in an institution of some kind or another. And I said, that might be right, but I refused to operate on that principle. And we got her everything we could get her to get her help. And she was gone for 3 years. She came back to our home 4 years ago. She's in 10th grade in a prep high school with a pretty high academic standard. She was in schools that taught her behavioral stuff for a long time. And her report card came on Monday, and it was straight A's. That's not possible. This is what's going on now, and this is harder than anything I've told you about. We're talking about what's going on lately, and everybody's had a tough year, you know, and I think mine's tough until I listen to yours, but now you get to listen to mine. The older one of the two is the perfect kid. All the focus in the house, all the energy, all the attention is on the one that's 2 years younger than her, because she's the one demanding the attention. She's the one who's got auditory hallucinations in her head, people that she talks to and can describe to you from age four. This is how she came out of that alcoholic home, and we're dealing with that, and it's everything. Her sister's 2 years older, is the perfect kid, straight A's in school, no problems, happy to be of service, suiting up, showing up, and not making any trouble. Doesn't want to take any resources against her little sister. About 7 weeks ago, she had a meltdown at school, and she told him she was suicidal. She's a senior in high school, about to graduate, and that she was planning to go outside the school and run in front of a car. And they sent a PET team to my school, my kid's high school, and picked her out of there and took her on a 5150 hold. I think it's absolutely a total contradiction in terms that my entire house with four members of the community, that I'm the only one that's never been on a psychiatric hold is just wrong. But apparently that's the case. And they put her in a psychiatric hospital for 5 days, and she came home and she was talking to a counselor, and she told the counselor that when she was 7 years old and in my care, she had been molested by a man who had taken in as my son, basically, my foster son, 25 years ago, molested her. She never told anybody. He's a guy who lives a block from my house. He's in my life. I got him his career. He works in my business. He worked for me for many years until about a year ago. And now I've got this information. I don't know what to do with it. And my child's molested on my watch when it was my job to keep her safe. Think about that for a second. How do you make amends to your child for not protecting them from a sexual predator? Never mind that you don't know about it. It's still my job. My ego says I should have known. I should have done something. I should have protected my child. And it was killing me. I had to go home and make amends to her for not protecting her from a sexual predator. Right? 10 days she's home, and she cut herself. More than 100 places. And I was at work. And my wife called me in a panic. She stood in the hallway in front of my wife with a sharp piece of a ceramic statue she'd broken and smiled at her as she was carving the last holes in her stomach. She had wounds on both legs and both arms, her stomach, her back, her upper chest. and she was bleeding all over the place. The paramedics came and medevaced her. I got the call. I'm at work. I came home from work, and I spent that night in the hospital watching my 17-year-old little girl bleed on the sheets. I called my sponsor, and this is a statement about how I was raised in recovery. I called my sponsor to tell him what was going on, and he had just lost his 46-year-old son and died of a massive heart attack. On the night that his son died, he was on the machines, and he was basically dead, and they were keeping him alive. On the night that they were to unplug him, my sponsor was standing at a podium at my men's meeting where he belonged. All right? That's how I'm raised. That's what I know. That's why I'm here. My wife's had surgery at home. I know what I'm supposed to do. And I went to a place that's as black as I've ever been, and I called my sponsor, and I told him what was going on, and his kid just died, man. And he says, I got nothing. Go to a meeting. He didn't say those words, but that was what came across. I got nothing for you. Go to a meeting. So I started going down the list of people who I call when the shit hits the fan. And some of them are not here anymore. I would call Dr. Paul. I would call Scott Redman. I would call people who are gone now. And I got down the list until I found one that was still alive and kicking. I called Bo T in Alabama. I told him what was going on. I talked to him today. And he told me a part of his story I didn't know. That when his son was killed, when him and his wife were in recovery, and he shared this story with you 14 years ago, that in recovery his son was killed by a drunk driver. I knew that. I knew about Al-Anon and AA showing up at his house for him and his wife when his son was killed. And it's a very highly impactful emotional story. He told me a part I didn't know. He says, on the day that she died, I was home loading my shotgun, and through my head was going this piece of information, that I'm powerless over the disease of alcoholism, but I can make the world safe from one of them. A member of AA showed up at his house and sat on the couch and walked him through what his family's life would look like if he took that action. And I'm a guy who thinks that don't just stand there, do something. That's my disease. I'm responsible. I've got to do something. If my father was alive, I guarantee you that he would have driven to this man's house who molested my child and knocked on the door and blown his head off. It would have been without question what he would do, and I would be expected to do the same. And I suffered bouts of shame that I didn't go kill him. That's my disease. I know that, but it's real for me. And I'm in a place where, I told Bo today, I was in a place where I couldn't hear anything. I can hear the blood in the canals in my ears like a jet plane spooling up for takeoff, and I can hear nothing else. And I had to sit in that for 3 weeks and do nothing because nothing was the right action to take. And I'm going to tell you how this works, and I don't know why. But 3 weeks ago, today, tomorrow, I went to my Saturday morning meeting and it went away. It was just suddenly gone from me. That I'm in this enormous amount of pain. Pain I've never experienced in my life. But there's a peace in here. And I know that it's there. And those things shouldn't exist in the same place, and they did. And 3 weeks ago, the lights came back on in my eyes. And my daughter's still in a halfway house. In a psychiatric hold. My wife is still injecting chemotherapy and is seriously ill. There's nothing that's changed in my life. I stayed in it until it was done with me, and then it was gone. That thing that I feared more than anything else in the world, that my feelings would get a hold of me and I'd never get loose, is a lie. And I went in my garage and I started polishing stones. Some of you have got them. I polish pocket rocks and I give them out to folks when I travel. And I started sharing at meetings again. I started showing up for life. I was there, but the best I could do was sit in my chair, hanging on with both hands, not letting it knock me out. And I'm back, and I don't know why that is. I know it's God. I know it's recovery. I know it's you. And I know that there's no shortcut to getting out of that. Some of you guys drank for that, man. When it was like that, you had to drink to get out. You had a way out. Drinking didn't get me out. I did violence to people to get me out. I cheated on my wife to get me out. I did stuff to get me out of it because I can't be right here right now just like everybody in this room, and I had to be in it until it was done with me, and it's not there anymore. And I owe it to people whose shoulders I'm standing on right now, like Bob and Paul, Dr. Paul and Scott and Bo and people that I've encountered along the way who did this for me and my family when I needed it desperately. And I'm so deeply honored that you guys asked me to come do this for you. And I'll be forever grateful for the life that you've given me and my family. Thank you.